95 Cents Non-Symposium presents session number 272, Decisions of the Soul, the Issues and Diverse Responses to Homosexuality and Heterosexual Marriage, a panel discussion with Mary Beth Rains, Dwight Cook, Rob Killian, and others.
It's the better part of a year, and I'd like to give you the context for how the project was organized, and then we can launch into the other parts of it. The diversity of situations in which non-heterosexual people experience the various forms of sexual orientation in relationships has only begun to be openly explored in the United States and other parts of the world. Today's panel presents one small segment of that diversity, that is, the internal experience of homosexual or bisexual men who are Mormon and who have married. Even within this narrow focus that we have chosen to examine today, a wide range of stories exist about how these men have become aware of their sexual orientation, how they have fallen in love, how they have dealt with being gay and Mormon, chosen to marry, and have come to their current marital status of remaining married or choosing to divorce. Since perspective is paramount in discussing any topic, let me begin with how this panel is organized and why we are not including some other groups of people who would obviously should be included in this discussion of homosexuality, bisexuality, and marriage. First, I am the spokesperson for this panel, but I only played a minor role in the preparation for today's presentation. A number of men and women associated with Family Fellowship, a group which provides supportive events for families of gays and lesbians with a Mormon background, have collaborated for several months to define this topic, to gather stories of former or currently married LDS gays and lesbians and their spouses, and to edit the collective stories and present them all today. The stories were sent in anonymously or with an author's name and were quite diverse. There were women, men, completely homosexual beings, bisexual, and transsexual. Unfortunately, only the men's stories were in sufficient number and depth to detail a pattern, so the organizers decided to limit our discussion today to LDS homosexual men who have married. Hopefully, more lesbian and bisexual women, as well as bisexual and transsexual persons, will add their stories to our collection so that possible publications can depict a wider range of experiences. A second point of perspective is that homosexual, bisexual, and transsexual people quite often traverse a circuitous and torturous path to finding an external form of life in relationships and the community that brings them peace in their inner hearts and souls. Many beyond our panelists today date in adolescence, fall in love with the opposite sex at times, marry, have children, and do all of the same things that heterosexual people do in also coming to a place of peace and balance. The search to find viable alternatives in a world which only gives heterosexual options is often fragmented, messy, or only partially integrated. When that search for wholeness includes a membership or a strong commitment to a spiritual community such as Mormonism, the path becomes even more complicated. Many soldiers returning to war over the centuries have looked crazy for months or years after their return. Also, victims of violence, catastrophic loss, or natural disaster look odd or out of step with a well-chosen life for long periods of time, even for the rest of their lives. We now have a name for the symptoms that produce a radical disorientation of the self, post-traumatic stress disorder. I suggest that homosexual, bisexual, or transsexual people also experience a radical disruption in the journey towards an integrated self because the outer geography of their social world does not reflect the inner geography of their emotional and relationship patterns. We all need adequate modeling and years of practice to even begin to approximate the expected social norms of our society. Given that these panelists have been much like immigrants into a land that does not speak their language nor know their patterns of attachment and love, I ask you to keep an open heart and mind as we all speak. For example, if you find yourself judging someone's actions or feelings, ask yourselves, what if I were transported into a world in which I could only legitimately fall in love and marry a person whom I should not be attracted to, and would I be able to let myself go through and feel okay internally as well as act appropriately socially? So each of the panels today will take a different segment, and I'd like to introduce each one of us. I'm included. And I have about two or three lists, which I'll juggle as we talk. After my introduction, Dwight Cook will give his comments about the collective stories and how the whole panel was organized and how the whole sets of stories were collected. Dwight is co-editor of Decisions of the Soul, LDS Personal Accounts of Same-Sex Attraction and Heterosexual Marriage. He's also national co-chair of the Committee on Education with the National Council on HIV Disease, a nonprofit foundation that conducts research on public health policy regarding HIV disease. He's also vice president for legislation of the Phoenix chapter of NCHIV, that above organization. Additionally, he is national co-chair of the Men's Health Committee for Affirmation Gay and Lesbian Mormons. Dwight lectures frequently on HIV, AIDS, and has lobbied for effective public policy both nationally and in Arizona. He has published in the Spanish magazine Karma 7 and authored the short story Silver Angels and Email, published by Family Fellowship. He shares joint custody of his two daughters with his former wife, Jan. They live in Arizona. He works as an engineer at Honeywell and is currently pursuing a master's degree in industrial engineering at Arizona State University. After Dwight is Rob Killian, who will give his personal experience. Rob is a divorced father of two sons. He is currently a senior resident in family practice in Rochester, New York. He grew up in Seattle, served a mission in Seoul, South Korea, and graduated from BYU in 1985 with a BA in international relations. He worked for a time for the National Security Agency and then returned to graduate school to pursue a career in medicine. He received his MD, MPH, from the University of Utah in May 1993. He is also co-editor of Decisions of the Soul and has writings that have also been published elsewhere. He currently volunteers as the medical director of Isaiah House, a two-bed home for the dying in Rochester, serves as the national public relations director of Affirmation, Gay and Lesbian Mormons, and spends much of his free time writing. He will be serving as a captain of the Air Force Medical Corps upon the conclusion of his medical training in Rochester. Our third panelist is Jerry Bowie. Let's see if I can find Jerry's notes here. Jerry has received his master's degree in social work, I'm assuming from the University of Utah. Is that correct? He works with issues surrounding sexual abuse. He has one daughter who is 3 years old. After Jerry will be Allison and Steve Dunn. They are on another paper. Allison is a mother of four. She is an English teacher and debate coach at a Logan High School, or at Logan High, I guess. She has a master's degree in instructional technology, and she's a counselor in the state primary presidency. Steve is father of four, the same four. He is the husband to Allison. He is a private consultant with two educational firms. He has a doctorate in exercise physiology from Brigham Young University, and he is a home teacher with Allison. I am next, in which I will give reflections on my reading of all the stories, many more of which are available were published in rough drafts beyond even the publication Decisions of the Soul. And my credentials are that I'm a licensed clinical social worker and a marriage and family therapist in private practice here in Salt Lake City. I'm co-editor of Peculiar People, Mormons and Same-Sex Attraction, along with Wayne Scow and Ron Scow, and I have published in Dialogue and Sunstone magazines from time to time over the years. I have three adult children, and I have had my first granddaughter this summer. Is there anyone else? We've introduced us all. Okay, Dwight, take it away, and I'll take my stuff away.
The first thing I want to do is plug our collection of stories available for sale at the back of the room upon completion today. And then I want to start with something that did not make it into Decisions of the Soul. This is a poem called Apart, and it was written by a gay Mormon father. It starts as this. In silence, I hold tight, I reach and grasp. Our fingers straining, barely touching. Your shining faces do not last. Pulling you, pulling me, pulling. Mother, the center of care, the dove, the inertia rolls, crushes, unyielding. I want to hold, to nurture, to love. But fathers earn, win, work unending. Now the roles have failed, bonds broken through. Unhappy one, now peaceful, lonely too. I want to take you with you, with me, to stay with you, to watch you grow tomorrow too. My soul fills with cold, red and angry. My arms swing in empty blue, but I will not fight, for I love the adversary, and the battlefields are you. In the end, the father yields the court's decree. Father's wallet is all that needs be. No, I want you to know me, not a deposit that next week will be. I'll watch you from afar, as close as I can. I'll touch you in my dreams, and you'll have peace, and I'll be on my way. Over a year ago, just slightly over a year ago, Family Fellowship approached Karen Swanick, Rob Killian, and myself with the prospect of participating in this project called their Personal Histories Project. The idea that our own stories and the stories of people like us might be published or made available in some way to others brought both excitement and fear. Excitement that perhaps others might learn or gain from our hard-learned lessons, and the fear of the vulnerability that comes when your innermost struggles, your deepest secrets, are opened publicly in complete honesty. Karen, Rob, and I face the challenge with total conviction. Conviction to the power of personal stories. We circulated a call for papers in every direction we could think of. We worked through contacts in Affirmation, Gamophytes, the Gay Mormon Fathers Group, in Evergreen, in Reconciliation, and across the internet. Family Fellowship published a call for papers, as did Affirmation, and shortly before the deadline, the stories began to arrive. I still get chills as I think about the souls that arrived in our mailboxes and the responsibility that I felt as I held those manuscripts in my hand, the years of internal turmoil contained in those pages, the fallen dreams, broken hopes, and the tremendous loss as fathers and mothers are separated from their lives, from their children, as expressed in the poem that I read earlier. But also within those pages is the joy and breathtaking liberation as the inner self is discovered and embraced. We receive papers from people in every position in life, in the church as well as in secular life, a former assistant to the First Presidency, a former mission president, a doctor, a lawyer, a professor at BYU, a student, a psychotherapist, and good grief, even an engineer. We received over twice the number of stories that we had originally anticipated, and my greatest regret is that we were only able to include 17 of those stories in Decisions of the Soul. There were many well-written and moving stories that we were not able to include. And more importantly, each day as I meet new people, I am made increasingly aware of the stories that aren't contained in the book and that were not submitted. Those stories that contained in Decisions of the Soul are just a drop in the barrel in view of all the stories that are out there. Due to the volume of stories received from gay LDS men, this series, the first one in the Family Fellowship Histories Project series, deals with gay men only. But Family Fellowship is continuing its effort, and Rob, Karen, and I, along with many others, will continue in that process. We invite all interested parties to submit their stories and to participate. There is a place for all personal histories, and we welcome them all. Additionally, in the near future, we hope to publish a series on spouses of lesbians and gay men, on HIV disease and related stories, and on Mormon lesbians who have married. With regard to the lesbians, I'm reminded of something that Mel White, the former ghostwriter for Jerry Falwell, Jim Baker, and Pat Robertson, said recently regarding his own homosexuality. I'll paraphrase. Choose it. Who would choose it? If I could choose it, I'd really rather be a lesbian. So if you are a lesbian who has married or know one, we would really like your story. I have encountered such love in the lesbian couples I have come to know, as well as in the one lesbian that I know that has decided to stay married for the time being. We want to document that love and that courage. They are stories that need to be told. Today we are here to share with you part of what is contained in our first series, Decisions of the Soul. We are very grateful to Family Fellowship and Sunstone for giving us this opportunity. And we are grateful to Mary Beth Raines, Romel McElprang, and Gary Watts for their wonderful guidance and professional contribution. And we are especially grateful to Ron Scow for his hours and hours of editing, guidance, and encouragement. Our intent in the panel today is the same as our intent in collecting and publishing these stories. We want to give you a cross-section of the responses to homosexuality and heterosexual marriage. These panelists, like those whose stories are in the book, have graciously agreed to share their innermost struggles, their tears, their joys with you today. They have the courage to face the possible repercussions from doing so publicly. They are all moving stories. They are stories of tremendous courage, of faith, and love. They are stories that say to all of us, church leaders, LDS social services, independent professionals, and lay members of the church, it is time to stop the demonization. It is time to stop the hatred. It is time to have the courage to stop and admit that we do not understand this issue. It is time to respect the individual with all its diversity. It is great pride that I introduce to you this panel today, as well as the collection of their stories contained in Decisions of the Soul.
I'm in a very emotional place today. I just said goodbye to my boys. Living in New York, I don't see them very often. But I had them the last week, and we had a great week. I titled my story, No Longer Afraid, because that is exactly what I feel. I feel that finally my life is my own, and I have faced my fears and my greatest demons. And that's the reason I can speak with pride and joy. Being a homosexual is not just about the sex. Being a gay man out and open is about being a survivor. And I found it is an honor to tell my story. It has been such an experience to put it down on paper and send it out. The phone calls, letters, and contacts have been powerful and heartfelt that have come back to me. The stories I've heard and received in return have all been worth the fear and pain of telling my own story. I really do wish I could be standing here next to my ex-wife, Jolene, so that we could both share the story from our different perspectives. I wish you could hear her pain and the struggle she continues to have as a divorced mother of two sons and as a true believing Mormon. I also wish that she and I could be closer because she is wonderful. But this week marks the third year of our separation and subsequent divorce, and she remains distant, unable to resolve the conflicts this experience has brought into her life. To divorce was the most difficult decision I have ever had to make. The anticipated pain of that choice kept both my wife and I in our marriage for extra years of pain and indecision and stagnation. The years were full of disappointment in each other and in ourselves. We tried to do what we believed was right, to stay married, to hide the conflict that my differing sexual orientation brought to the relationship, and to raise our children in a traditional family. It did not work for us. We did not meet at the deepest emotional places, and the unhappiness in that became palpable in our home and in our interactions with each other. I realized that I was homosexual when I was a deacon. I was sitting in the annual talk given to the Aaronic priesthood by Bishop Volkman, my ward bishop. I had just turned 12 and felt very mature and excited to be a priesthood holder. I remember that day so vividly. I honestly did not understand much of what Bishop Volkman was talking about, but I knew that the subject was sex. he spent much of the time on a word called masturbation and the slang term for that and how bad that was, but I had no clue. He explained that that horrible thing led people to become homosexual. And as he described what that meant in the most horrible and darkest language, I somehow came to understand that he was talking about me. I had always been aware of a special, sensitive part of me that seemed different from other boys. I had never been able to define it. I had learned to protect it and not share those feelings that seemed so unique to me. In the discussion given by Bishop Folkman, that gift inside of me turned into a curse, and it became ugly and unwanted. I felt guilty. I also felt confused because I had not done this masturbation thing, so I had no idea how I had become homosexual. I searched my memory for anything I could have done to have chosen or to have been punished for, and yet I couldn't find anything and thus found it difficult to repent of. I vowed that day that I would repent, however, and I proved to my Heavenly Father that I was not this horrible thing. I was going to be the most worthy of his servants, the most diligent of my faith, and thus began an adolescence filled with church activities, true belief, testimony, and service. It also began an adolescence of self-righteousness and self-hatred. I was the best little boy in the world on the outside, but inside I was evil and ugly. No longer. After my mission, I threw myself into my studies at the Y, but after a couple of semesters, I felt lost, unfulfilled, and unsure of myself. I felt unworthy despite a clean moral record and faithful church service because these feelings had never gone away. I remember walking across campus and realizing that I was not learning anything new in my studies. I had only been taking safe classes, and I was wasting my education. Sure, my grades were good, but I was unhappy, and I was not growing. I also felt incredibly lonely and unsure of where I was to take my life. I decided that day, with that insight, to take some time away from BYU and to explore my academic and political interests, and so signed up to spend a semester in Washington, D.C. with the BYU Washington Seminar Program. I had always grown up planning to be the first Mormon senator from the state of Washington, and so I thought that would be a good place to see my future. One of the other students on that program was named Steve, and he and I bonded quickly as we prepared for our winter in Washington, and we became great friends. I had never had a best friend and had always felt some distance from other young men growing up, yet Steve seemed very different from other guys. We read the same books, cared passionately about politics and the church. We loved movies and the theater, and we spent much of our free time in those months in Washington together. As the days passed in Washington, I began to question why I was so different and so alone. That word, homosexual, began to enter my conscience again, and curiosity about that led me to one-night venture into the DuPont Circle area of Washington with the specific mission to spy on homosexuals and see what they looked like. I had heard that that area was where they hung out. I worked late in the office so that I had an excuse to miss dinner back at the apartment and went to DuPont Circle. I found a bagel shop, sat down, ate a sandwich, and sort of peered out the window waiting to see someone odd or abnormal. And there was none to be seen. It was with somewhat of a heavy heart that I walked back to the metro station to await a train to take me back to Northern Virginia in my apartment. Waiting there at the station was only one other person, and because it was the off late night hours, the wait was a long one. This fellow came over to me and struck up a conversation. I found him interesting and incredibly good-looking. He also had a very responsible position in the Reagan administration. He was older, professionally dressed, and I enjoyed the conversation with him. But it also obviously became obvious to me that he was attracted to me as well. I began wondering about his interest in me, and that titillated me. He was so normal and so nice, and so I pursued the conversation just so that I could finally get to know a homosexual. The train arrived, and we rode together to the Pentagon to pick up the buses that would take us to our separate apartments. His was waiting when we got to the Pentagon, and he invited me home with him to see his apartment and to continue the conversation. I was a little taken back and shocked, but begged off and told him no, thank you. Yet, in my heart, I was screaming yes. I watched as he walked onto his bus and looked back at me as it pulled away. I then began to cry. The tears were tears of anger because I had been so tempted so easily. I surprised myself by the power of the desire in me to go home with this stranger. I felt like I was missing out on some great opportunity. I assumed he would have wanted to have sex with me. This was the early 1980s, but I did not even know what that meant between two men. I just wanted to hold and to touch him, and I wanted to be held. I had never been held. And for the first time in my life, I realized just how lonely I was. I'm glad we can read this here. I made it back to my apartment but could not sleep. I muffled my tears with my pillow and got up with the dawn and went back to the work. I was very distraught and could barely function in the office, and so called my friend Steve and made plans to meet him after work. I realized that I was either going to die or share this terrible news with somebody. I did not think of the consequences of telling my best friend, other than that maybe he would hate me. That night when I met Steve, the story of the previous evening just poured out. He was very quiet and then told me of his own homosexual desires and temptations. I could not believe there was another Mormon like me. I could not believe my best friend shared even this horrible cross with me. We talked for hours and pledged to help each other remain true to our covenants and to our life plans to be of service to God's kingdom. The weeks went by and Steve and I became inseparable. I remember one long weekend we spontaneously decided to go to Charleston, South Carolina to discover the city that we had read about in a book that we shared. The trip was a wonderful excursion away from Washington, and on the return trip we spent the last night in Myrtle Beach, North Carolina, in a very cheap motel room right on the beach. That night HBO was showing a movie called Making Love about a married man, a physician, who recognizes his homosexuality and leaves his wife for another man and moves to New York. The movie profoundly affected me. Steve just went to sleep, however. I sat in my bed and while watching him began to realize that I was in love with this wonderful man, peacefully sleeping in the bed next to mine. All I wanted then was to get into his bed and hold him and tell him of this newfound insight. Instead, I got up and went for a walk along the beach. I cried and prayed and wondered what was wrong with me. I even remember running into the waves. And letting the cold water pound against my legs, my spirit was truly spent. A few weeks later, Steve ended our friendship abruptly and completely without explanation. I figured he must be sensing that I had passed some limit, that he knew I had fallen in love with him. And I assumed that I was now even more untouchable. I returned to Provo more alone than I had ever been, because now I knew. I made it a point to see my bishop, and I confessed my sin of falling in love with another man. I asked for his blessing. He seemed shocked that I had never had sex and that I was temple worthy. He told me how rare that was when someone came to him with this problem. He told me that this meant I was not really homosexual and that I was worthy of all of Heavenly Father's blessings. He then blessed me and promised me in that blessing that if I married a worthy daughter of God in the temple, I would be cured. Thus began a valiant pursuit of the only girl I knew in Provo. Jolene and I had dated a couple times before my leaving for Washington, and we had written during that semester. I began dating her diligently and worked on falling in love. We were married in the Idaho Falls Temple 3 months later. Seemed so easy. It was like a business decision. That's how we often described it. Did I love her? I did fall in love with her over time. I was fascinated by her. I admired her and still think she is a very special person. I am proud to have... two sons with her. And I miss her. I miss her friendship and her concern. One of my true sins in life is the pain I have brought into hers. How innocent my intentions seem in retrospect, yet how devastating those intentions have proved to be. It was harder to ignore my homosexuality once I was sexually active inside of my marriage. Everywhere I looked, I found attractive men. I had to hide this from Jolene and from myself. I tried to convince myself that these were feelings of envy because I wanted to look like these men. I soon tired of spontaneous sex, and our sex life became very perfunctory. I felt like I was a fraud. And the daily living, this lie took its toll on both of our spirits and on our marriage. The years went by, and the marriage became an unhappy one. We both pursued graduate education, and as I said earlier, we had two beautiful children. Yet as the years went by, I became more sure that I was despised not only by my church and my community, but by God as well. I began to think that I should die. These feelings started because I began to realize how much pain I was bringing to other people. I felt that despite many, many years of dedicated and sincere effort, God had not taken these homosexual feelings away, but they were stronger and more persistent. It became obvious to me at that point that no matter what option I chose, everyone would be hurt. To stay in the marriage was not healthy for our sons or for each of us. Death seemed like it was safer because my secrets could go with me, my wife would be free of me, and the boys would have a chance at having a happier and a much more worthy father. Luckily, I could not leave them. That is what finally dissuaded me each time I came close. During that time, I was now a medical student and in my third year of training, and I took a psychiatry rotation, and it became obvious to me that I was as sick or sicker than most of my patients. I also had met many medical students and physicians and other medical professionals who were gay and lesbian, who were healthy, happy, and great role models. They were not the stereotypes that I had grown to fear. However, I could not share with them my story, but I watched and observed their lives. And in that third year after psychiatry, I decided I had to make a choice. And I chose to live. I chose health, and I chose to live honestly. I do not remember choosing my sexual and emotional orientation. Jolene and I chose to divorce, but only after counseling and many hours of discussion. I realized that the boys needed to see me honest and happy, and they needed to learn vicariously by my journey that God did love and cherish each of us. That was a very fast paragraph, but that covers about 5 years of incredible struggle. I grew up with guilt and fear as a norm. I felt I was of little value. As a gay man, I am constantly told not to believe my feelings. I'm told to pretend to fit in and to deny myself love and companionship. I have been taught to lie. But it hurts to lie. There are no secrets with God. There should be no secrets with God's people. It hurts our community, our families, and ourselves. 3 years since Jolene moved out and took the boys to Provo. And we started the process then of creating a new life and learning how to be co-parents as we both were struggling to redefine our own selves. I finished medical school and I'm now nearly finished with my residency training. I am living. I am a father, and I have and love my two sons. I am actually happy. And I am amazed at how productive and creative I am now that I do not waste so much personal energy in hiding. I have learned in the last few years that I needed to heal, and I have now begun to reach out to others. To be healed is not to be free of pain or suffering, but to be healed is to be whole, to find joy and love amid the suffering. I am so glad to have found the fresh air of honesty, to have learned the joy of living this dance called life with other survivors and other human beings. I am so glad for those who helped me stay alive along the way, and for those who helped tear down my walls of shame and hiding. I thank God for my life. I thank God for my sons, and I thank God for their mother. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jerry. The name of my article, I entitled it, Who Says Angels Aren't Supposed to Cry? I picked that line out of a Patti LaBelle song, and it was my love for Patti LaBelle that convinced me that I was gay. But she, one of her songs says, what's the name of the song it comes from? But that line spoke a lot to me during my coming out and as I was trying to figure out what the future of my life would look like. I think I've been sitting over there in denial because I'm feeling a lot of things now that I didn't feel sitting right there. I want to share with you a little bit about my history, because I think it's pretty similar to a lot of people in this experience, and that is, you know, growing up, I'm aware that I was taught very well to suppress who I was, to suppress my opinions, my feelings, and to not be okay with who I was. And so staying in the closet was a pretty natural place for me to be until I got married. I'm a convert to the church, I went into the military, and that's where I came across the church in my life. I realized there was a problem when the missionaries taught me about the laws of chastity and told me the do's and the don'ts. And they told me more about the don'ts. And I realized that there was going to be a problem. And I decided, well, you know, I can keep this hidden. But I was bothered because I was attracted to men, had fantasies, and knew that that was not okay. And every time the word homosexual or gay was spoken in church, I was reminded that I was evil and not okay with the church. I became obsessed with the church. I worked, and I was an LDS church member, and that was my life. People prophesized that I was going to be a general authority, and I was going to run the stake, and all these great things. All I needed to do was to serve my mission and get married and go through all the protocol. I realized one of the missionaries gave me a pamphlet for boys only. And, you know, I think about this. I remember reading that pamphlet and just being in my house and just devastated, crying. I mean, I just knew that I couldn't do this. I called Salt Lake City and said, what can we do? And they said, go do all this therapy and you'll be cured and get married and good stuff like that. I became obsessed with fasting. I don't think I was a genuine anorexic. It wasn't about what my body looked like. James Talmadge in, I believe it was Jesus the Christ, talked about there are some things that only fasting and prayer could take care of, and that was going to be my remedy. And I lost 60 pounds, was removed from the military because I kept passing out. And they couldn't understand what was wrong with me, and I knew that they would never understand. I went on my mission. I want to add, I was seeing counselors during this time. My first counselor, I finally, after a couple months of therapy, approached my LDS counselor and said, you know, I find that I'm really attracted to men. I didn't say it that calmly. This really concerns me that I might be gay, and what does that mean? And he informed me that I just didn't have the symptoms. So I walked away from his office aware that I didn't have the symptoms, but still pretty attracted to him. I went on my mission, and again was pretty obsessed. I thought, certainly a mission will take care of this. It didn't. My mission president on several occasions had to tell me to slow down. He finally had to write out a schedule saying, look, you need to take breaks at this time and this time and this time. You're driving your companions crazy. And I thought, you have little faith. You don't understand what I'm trying to do here. I never disclosed to him what was going on, but I just realized that pattern, that I just became very obsessed. Went to BYU because that was going to do it. I decided I needed to get married. I wanted to get married. I wanted to have a family. I wanted things to be right in the eyes of the Lord. I met my wife at a party. I thought she was an attractive woman, very pleasant, very outgoing, and we shared a lot of commonalities. When it came time to decide to do something with the relationship and that, with all the pressures that come with that within a Mormon community, I knew I probably shouldn't have gotten married. I couldn't disappoint her. I don't know if that sounds narcissistic, but I knew that this is what she wanted. And I honestly thought that I could just pretend that the only person I was going to hurt was me. And no big deal. I had never been sexually active otherwise. It was just not going to be any big deal, but I became very concerned about, we were engaged, and I knew that the inevitable, the honeymoon, was going to happen. And I was very concerned about what's going to happen. Am I going to be able to perform? You know, am I going to be able to be adequately attracted to make this work? That's when I saw my second counselor at BYU. And I got this wonderful lecture about how dysfunctional my relationship was with my father, and that if I just went and played baseball and hung around with the guys, I would be okay. I think I'm okay, but I don't think I fit his definition of that okayness. I finally talked to a bishop and some church leaders who said, you're a virgin, you just don't know what you've missed. And if you get married, things will be okay. I'm not blaming them for my choices. I made a choice to get married. I'm totally accountable for that. Our marriage was fine, except for the intimacy part of it. And I'm not just talking about sexual intimacy, but my ability to be close to my wife was complicated because I had a secret. And secrets don't work in relationships very well. And my secrecy was that my attraction was not towards her, towards females, that it was, you know, of a homosexual orientation. During the time of our relationship, sex just became a very... experience for me, just didn't work very well. I think I continued throughout our relationship thinking that everything was could be okay if I just kept the secret good enough. If I just, you know, played these head games inside myself long enough, everything would be okay. Then I went to graduate school. And being a social worker, they challenge you on every level, and I think that's appropriate to to be a good therapist, you need to have some things resolved in your life. I was working with people. I work with a lot of sexual abuse issues with offenders and victims, and so I'm dealing with people on a lot of different levels about sexual issues, and I found that I was leaving my office feeling very hypocritical. You know, I'm telling these people how damaging secrets were, and here I had this huge one in my life. In one of my classes on racism, I read an article on cultural wounding, and part of that article suggested how racism creates victims in much the same way that sexual abuse victims go throughout their life with a sense of wounding, why they maintain this secret. And it, just a little line in there stated that a lot of homosexuals who've been in the closet, it made this parallel, made a comparison that totally struck me as this was my life. And I couldn't face the illusion that I was the only one I was hurting, because I was aware that my wife was struggling, what was wrong with her. You know, I knew that she knew. She was wondering what was wrong with her. And there was absolutely nothing wrong with her. So I decided, after reading that article and talking to a professor and spending some time with a therapist who finally could be where I was at, who would allow me the freedom to talk about these issues and to support my own process of coming out to myself, I decided it was time to tell my wife. And I'm just going to read this out of my article. My wife, who I consider a very intuitive person, had picked up on my depression and pressured my honesty. Although I was ready, the fear was incredible. That night we lay together in bed in the dark. I was glad it was dark because I could not look my wife in the eyes. I could not believe I was about to destroy the life she had come to trust. After several struggling attempts, I finally spit out the words, "I might be gay." She wanted me to make sure that I told you that I said might, because I couldn't say I was gay. Her response was tears. Not just tears of sadness, but tears that expressed every fear a wife could possess. Tears that expressed the inability to compete or to comprehend. Tears that reflected doubt and dashed hopes. And expectations of an eternal life together. That night changed everything for us. We weren't sure what was going to happen. She started seeing a counselor, the same one that I was seeing, and we both were on a journey of self-discovery. The church, in my mind, I had kind of struggled with my relationship with the church since I had gotten married. At the time, I was in a church calling, and I decided that the church was not the healthiest place for me to be, that I needed some space from that. When I left the church, I understood that as far as the church went, I probably would never be back. As far as the gospel, I don't think I've ever left the gospel. I went to my Sunday school class to explain to them that I would not be back and to let them know that this wasn't about them. They were a bunch of rowdy 13-year-olds and had lost several teachers. So I wanted them to be clear that it wasn't because I was rejecting them, that I was leaving the church. I left the class and walked out of the church and walked towards home. The pain of expectations and the realization that the gospel was not about changing my sexual orientation hit me while walking home, and I shed tears of loss. There was a death within me that occurred at that moment. I realized that the last 10 years of dedicated worship, study, service, and hope to have my sin taken from me had been misdirected. My spirituality before that time was about being validated by the institution of the church, Without that validation, I'm now forced to look within myself for some spiritual confirmation and not the church. And at that time I wrote that, I thought that was a bad thing. And I'm actually grateful that that's where I'm at right now. I went to the bishop. Of course, when you walk out of a Sunday school class, you just don't get to walk out. He wanted to have a talk. I had decided at that time, because I needed space to make my own decisions, that I did not want to disclose to him what was going on. My wife also asked that I not do that because the ramifications for her would be on a different level. I'm kind of glad I didn't do that because I talked to the bishop about we were struggling in our relationship, probably we're going to be divorcing, and that we were trying to reconcile things on our own level. I asked him not to staff that, not to take that to bishop correlation meeting, that sweet bishop. Our next door neighbors came over to inform us that their home teachers were wondering how the Bowies were doing because that they had heard we were having problems. No one in the ward knew anything other than the bishop. And then I want to share with you a little bit about my wife's experience with the bishop when she finally did talk to him. And I guess part of my hope of being here today was that somewhere in here there's a church leader who will not do this. My wife did nothing wrong. She is the most faithful person I have ever experienced in my life. That's why I was attracted to her. She has a very sweet heart. At most, she made a poor choice in not asking me if I was gay or straight, and I probably wouldn't have been honest with her at the time. This is what happened as she talked to the bishop. The bishop, she wrote this part of the paper. She goes, "When I went into the office, the bishop requested that we kneel in prayer, after which the bishop asked me, 'Why are you getting a divorce?' I told him it was because Jerry was gay. The bishop began to make statements that homosexuality was the most selfish act other than suicide. He then said, 'I need to take you to the hospital to get tested for AIDS.' I told the bishop that Jerry had only been sexual with me. His reply was, 'These people lie.' His office was as cold as ice. He then stated, 'You need to be using a condom.'" A side note is my wife's initial reaction was, "I don't have a penis." The shock for me was overwhelming. I had expected this priesthood holder to be understanding and supportive, and all I received was harassment. It was then that I felt compelled to address the chill and coldness of the interview, and I said, "Wait a minute. Jerry is a kind, spiritual person." The bishop's response, "So was Satan." As I picked my mouth up off the floor, he could see my shock and said, "I see that was a little harsh." I said, "Yes, I am offended." And then she explains, I'm explained that I have experience through this. I know that homosexuality is a real thing, and I know that Heavenly Father loves Jerry. I know that I don't understand everything, but I know that God is a loving judge. At this point, the spirit was very strong, which the bishop abruptly killed with the statement that Jerry could love anything, including a stump. He also stated that they breed those people, I think he was implying homosexuals, in Salt Lake City. And there's a good crop there, too. The bishop then pursued trying to locate Jerry through me, which I refused to cooperate with him. My wife's a hairstylist, and everyone in Utah County knows the situation, and it's amazing. I have experienced no backlash. She has been criticized. All people have is answers for her. I'm not so sure that anyone has been very supportive. I guess I would hope that if anyone leaves here today or a church leader, that they would follow the Spirit and offer a spirit of support to wives who are dealing with these issues, as well as homosexuals dealing with it in the congregations. I feel, since I have come out, despite all the struggles that we have had, I have felt a sense of peace that has preluded all the pain and struggles. I don't know if that's psychological or spiritual, but I'm convinced that God has not forsaken myself or my wife. Our paths have been very different, but I know that God's there. I didn't spend all that time studying and worship to realize that just because I'm gay, that he has excluded me in his plan. I may not understand what that's about, but I know I haven't been excluded. Thank you.
We have a time constraint, so we will hurry so we can open up the panel for discussion. It's interesting to sit there and listen to other men who have been through what I've been through, and to feel their pain. And it's been incredible in my life to think that I was alone for all those years, and now to know that there are other men who have been where I am. I'm a gay man in a heterosexual marriage, and I'm frightened to be here and to speak to you. I'm also a father, a brother, a son, an educator, a former athlete, and an old coach. I have vigorously struggled all of my life to keep hidden the very issue that Allison and I are on this panel to discuss with you. For most of my life, I was petrified into silence. I had built walls so thick that nobody could get through, not even the people I loved the most. Until recently, I trusted no one in my life. No one. Not Allison, not my parents, not my children, not my siblings, and particularly not church members, colleagues, neighbors, or friends. I believed, and still believe, that if people really knew me, they would hate me. I continue to struggle with trust issues, but I have finally found someone in my life whom I trust implicitly. Allison. I know there will be times I know there will be times when she will hurt me and that I will hurt her. But those hurts will be unintentional. I think Allison is one of the truly great Christians. Sorry. It's your fault. It's your fault. In addition, I'm also concerned about some of you in the audience and others like me throughout the church. This is the main reason Allison and I are here. I know there are thousands of other couples who are at varying stages in the process my wife and I are engaged in. Some of them are in denial and are hiding. They know something is critically and fundamentally wrong with their marriages. They just don't know what it is, or they aren't telling what it is. Others of them know, but they are trying to maintain status quo, and they are putting up a false front. And others are dealing with the issue honestly and compassionately. My coming out publicly is for all of them and for you. It is also for those who have gay family members but don't know it, because these hidden family members are afraid to tell you. Or you know they are gay, but you are not dealing with it positively and lovingly. I want to help you know that being gay is not a sin, that it is not a shameful, dirty little secret, that gays are like everyone else, with one exception. They are attracted to and fall in love with somebody of the same sex. I want to be very clear before beginning this panel that I am inviting you into my living room to have a dialogue with you. I am not asking you into my bedroom. I am sure most of you would be uncomfortable talking about your sexuality in front of strangers. I'm just a tad uncomfortable talking about mine. Personally, I think it is none of your business what I do sexually or whom I love. However, homosexuality has been hidden and misunderstood for so long that discussions and panels like this one need to take place to educate and to enlighten. Right now, we'd like to share with you our brief history.
We will make this brief. Steve and I met at Utah State University when we were LDS Student Association officers. We were called to that office, and we spent a great deal of time with each other and enjoyed each other's company very much. And we spent really more than 2 years together before we got married. Very slow and very cautious people. And obviously for Stephen, this was a monumental decision, but I'm relatively cautious myself, so it was not atypical for us to do that. We knew and worked well with each other, and as you've heard today, we're wonderful friends and still are wonderful friends. And that's really a major part of the hurt, because for a wife who is in love with a gay man, he is the entire package she wants. It is a complete and total package. And it's everything she needs and wants. And to suddenly discover that the man that you love does not feel that way about you pretty much rips the carpet out from under your feet in a major way.
I had known earlier that I was gay, as most gay people do. I had a high school boyfriend. He was a swimmer for another school, and he and I met and started double dating and then spending evenings with each other, and we eventually became sexually active. We used to talk about the possibility of our being gay, but what we thought was gay back in the 60s was not what we were, so we said, we can't be gay. This is not what we are. I eventually ended the relationship because I knew if I were sexually active, I couldn't go on a mission for the Mormon Church, and I desperately wanted to do that. I also desperately wanted to have a family, so I ended it. And a year later, I found myself in a bishop's office at the university where I was attending and confessed my sins. And I told him that I had not participated in any homosexual acts since being with my boyfriend. He informed me at the time that since it had been over a year and since I had confessed it, that it would be appropriate for me to go on a mission, and that when I came back, if I married in the temple, as you have heard, and if I stayed faithful and began to have sexual relations with the woman, that my feelings of homosexuality would dissipate. Well, I did. I went on a mission, and I came back and dated several women and liked them, but didn't love any of them. And then I met Allison, and she and I became amazing friends. I was attracted to the quality of person that she is. And I was right. She is a quality person. I decided finally that it was time for me to marry. I was approaching my 25th year, and people were beginning to question why I wasn't married. And I thought, who could I marry? Marry your best friend. So I married Allison.
The early years of our marriage were very happy. And we had young children. We had a set of twins as our last birth, and so we were very busy with child rearing. But I began to know in those young years that there was a problem, because Steve's a very physical person. Physical things matter to him very much, and I seemed to be the only person that he was not physically attracted to. He hugged and touched, and I had to always be the sexual aggressor. I began to have serious problems with my self-esteem. I spent years and years waking up every morning saying, you must be the ugliest person in the world. You must be so unattractive. It must be that you don't keep house well enough. It must be that you're not bright enough. Or it must be that you don't take care of the children well. Whatever it was, there was always a reason, and it was always my fault. And I hear this again and again and again from women. And I've now met many women in the situation that I was in. And they all went through an incredible amount of self-loathing. Because the problem is you can't even talk about what the problem is. Because it's too horrible to even consider that this might be the problem. And then the first thing that happens is that you say to yourself, well, if I were just a really feminine woman, then this would not have happened to him. Or, you know, if I were just really, you know, adept in bed. Or if I were just really, I mean, a million very personal, very harmful things. And I started a really slow decline, and a wall went up between us in a very significant way. We could talk about anything on the planet except us, and I could do anything but touch him. And we both became extremely depressed and very lonely inside a very wonderful, potentially wonderful partnership. It became living in torment.
I had been faithful in the church for many years and was not sexually active at all. And I kept thinking, if I'm faithful, if I have enough trust in Christ, that he will change me, that I'll reach that corner and turn the corner. Well, the corner never came. In fact, it seemed to be getting further and further away because my attractions to men became stronger. And I began to despair that I would ever change. And I, fortunately, a few years ago, had a chance to talk to somebody that I knew was gay, and I felt safe to say to him that I had this tendency. He was able to introduce me to other gay men, and for the first time in my life I started to read about homosexuality, and I was over 40 years of age. I had never read anything about gays or homosexuals because I was afraid that if anybody caught me reading anything, that they would assume that I was gay. Therefore, I avoided the subject at all costs. Well, I began to read a book called Loving Someone Gay. And I would take notes in the margins and underline passages that were important to me. And on a trip that I had to take, I'd gotten the book out to take with me. This was 2.5 years ago. And I left the book on the bed in our bedroom. I had no intention of doing that, but I did.
Consciously.
Yeah, and consciously. That's right, consciously. I had no intention. Allison and I continued to communicate while I was traveling, and I knew that something was wrong when we talked the evenings that I was out. And I was praying to God that she had not found the book, that I had left it somewhere hidden. But I was fearful that she had found it and had read it. I remember returning home after having been gone for about 4 days and walking tentatively into the house, fearful that there would be an explosion. Nothing happened, but I could tell there was a strain. And we went about our business and put the kids to bed, and finally I went into our bedroom. I had tried to find the book and couldn't find it. But I remember as I walked in to go to bed, I noticed the book on the nightstand, and I had not put it there. So I knew that Allison had seen it, and I knew that if she had seen it, she had read it. And I'd like to read how I responded. For 20 years, this was the very moment I feared most. I immediately decided there was nothing I could do but to respond honestly to anything she might ask. I spoke first, and I simply said, "It's true." She inhaled, and she started to cry, and so did I. I was now terrified of her response. I was convinced that I was such a loathsome creature that she would dismiss me immediately from her life, turn her back on me, and leave me isolated. And leave me isolated and alone. I knew I would not live if she hated me, so her reaction was crucial. I was surprised and unnerved by her gentle, kind, and concerned response. I have told Allison many times that I am alive today because of her, and it is true. She is my personal savior, because without her love and continued fidelity, I would have killed myself. Occasionally, we are able to laugh about our journey of the past 2.5 years. Whenever she jokingly wants to threaten me to do something for her, she will remind me that I owe her my life. And I willingly do what she asks because I know it is true. I owe her my life.
Before I get sainthood, you need to know that I went through a terribly dark period when it suddenly occurred to me and made perfect sense to me that Stephen had had to fantasize about men when he was making love to me. And, I mean, that was a slow revelation after a while, but it came. And the quality of being touched when you are really wanted, I think, is probably very different from the quality of friendship or obligatory touch. And we spent one afternoon in the car, I remember, and I kind of blew an amazing gasket. And I think it's all right to say that we have been through that experience. I was so angry that I hit Steve as hard as I possibly could for as long as I possibly could. And the frightening thing was that he just sat there and took it, looking like he deserved every moment of that. The real horrible thing for people, for women who love gay men, is that we can't even get a good, healthy, clean, angry burn going to make a separation, because you know they didn't choose this, because you know them. You know them from the inside of their soul to the bottom of their toes. You know what toothpaste they love. You know what they think, what they feel, what they pray. And you know they wouldn't choose this. They're not lying about that. So if you hate them and are furious at them, it's for something they didn't choose and didn't do, and they usually were advised by people they trusted and loved that if they would just marry you, it would be okay. And so they went into it with this burning determination to love you intensely, which I think is many times more than a lot of people get in a marriage commitment. They really wanted to try and make it work. And so now you have this friend that you adore who can't love you, and you need to cut off your right arm, which is something you need and love. And so it is more complex than a normal divorce and more painful than a normal divorce. And add that to the fact that everyone in the world thinks you're crazy, because you still speak with him and love him and care for him. And the world for those women is extraordinarily complicated, and the church is little or no help, if not injury, frequently in those cases. We got into counseling immediately. I dragged Steve down to counseling, and we also started reading, and both of those things were extraordinarily helpful for us.
One of the things that helped me was to finally realize that I wasn't going to change, that elusive corner was not ever going to appear. And when that finally happened, I became furious, because I had trusted the church and I had trusted God that that would happen. The way it was explained to me by Allison was that we're given a deck of cards, Steve, that we have to play this hand, and we're not going to be given another deck of cards. No one's going to deal us another hand. God's not going to come down and swoop us out of our circumstances and change life for us. So we must deal with what we have to deal with. Well, for a long time, I hated the church. I hated the general authorities and their seemingly perfect lives. I hated God for what he had allowed to happen to me. I was filled with inconceivable rancor, which was foreign to my nature, and I was distressed by it. I would probably still feel similar emotions if it weren't for Allison's example. Months after her discovery, Allison continued to give me her unconditional love. I was astounded. I had been warned not to trust initial reactions, so I had approached our continuing relationship tentatively. But I was beginning to accept the fact that Allison truly loved me. Then I was struck by this thought. I have unintentionally hurt Allison deeply and profoundly. Yet she continues to love me. The church has unintentionally hurt me deeply and profoundly. How can I expect Allison to love and forgive me while I remain bitterly angry with the church? I wanted to be as benevolent as Allison. Therefore, I had to forgive the church and love those who unwittingly had become my enemies. I had been taught this charitable principle in primary, but it was the first time in my life I had experienced unconditional love. I immediately began a significant adjustment in my perspective.
One of the hallmarks, the things that we decided that we needed to do as we went through this experience, was there were very few decisions. The parameters were, is it kind? And is it honest? And those became our guiding principles. We didn't tell anyone for a while. We thought it was very best that we be healthy and strong before we told our children, so that they would have a resource to rely on. So we went to counseling and slogged through a year that I would not wish on my worst enemy. We decided that handling the situation well and modeling good behavior and telling our children that we accepted each other the way we were and loved each other was going to be the hallmark, because otherwise we were going to inflict terrible insecurity on our children. We did not want to encourage the concept of disposable people in anyone's life, and certainly not in our family. We're really out of time. Let me just... there's something that I think is really... that we see. I'm here because I think it's really important to say in words of very clear monosyllables that it is essential that we be aware of the consequences of the current manner in which the church and our communities, even larger than the church, think and speak about homosexuality. I have felt compelled to be here. It is healing for me to try and stand in the road and wave the red flag and say, don't do this. Don't do this. This is not the way to go. There are hundreds of thousands of us whose lives are touched by this. It is not a few of us. It is many of us. It is thousands of us. As long as we speak and think about homosexuality as perverse defiance of authority or attraction or a sick choice, which it is not, we will further alienate and frighten young children. As you can hear the stories of these men, they are aware, and I'm sure gay people are all aware, or many of them are aware, that there's something different or something going on. From the talks I've had with them, that's validated over and over again, that they are aware when they're young. So we're not talking about people who jump into this experience as full-blown adults. We're frightening little children to death. They're too afraid to talk with us and speak with us. And I'm a primary worker, and that makes me furious. They're already unsure of how to handle same-sex feelings and thoughts, and we scare them to death and scare them away. And as long as we say to people with same-sex feelings, you can choose differently, obey, all will be well, repress, you won't feel these things, marry, it will be fixed. As long as we say these things in an overt or even an implied cultural way, we will guarantee that this experience happens over and over and over again, and we need to get this out on the table and speak about it honestly, kindly, and openly. A marriage partner, someone who loves and trusts, is ultimately the finish line for many LDS people who don't believe in premarital sex. Here's the last sacrifice and the last jump. Just get married and it will work. You've never had sex with a woman. It can happen. You've never had sex with a man. You'll be happier. We are the last sacrifice to prove willingness and obedience and dedication to the gospel. And this is not the way to start a marriage. Marriages are tough enough anyway. It has to start with that bonding in place and that honesty in place. Do not even start it in the youth and hormone optimism of 18 and 19 and 20 that you can pull this off, because Stephen and I can tell you from the perspective of 22 years that it will wear at you and eat at you in a way that you cannot believe over those decades. I love Stephen. He's my best friend. I will continue to love him. He's the father of my children, and I'm grateful for that. But it hurts too much to watch his head turn and know that it's not me. And it hurts too much to know that he doesn't want to touch me. It's much more than sex. So we just hope that you will listen and have ears to hear, and that you will go out there and say, there are people who, if they say, oh, I think maybe I'd just get married anyway, that we need to love each other unconditionally, and we need to not pretend that we are not what we are.
Mine is a difficult task, because what I've been assigned to do is to give an overview of how I saw, from a therapist's point of view, the many stories that I read, and it will sound so analytical after these wonderful statements. And so given the shortness of time, I think I'm going to make just a couple of comments, and then we might have time for a couple of questions. First of all, in all of the stories, the amount of courage is impressive, and particularly the way it needs to be explained, I think, in that when one first knows one is gay or homosexual, one doesn't have words for it. It's a sensate experience, or it's experience without words. We understand ourselves when we're mirrored, and we get labels from the outside. And oftentimes this awareness comes at such a young age that you're still in that right or wrong, good or bad stage, in the stage of magical thinking, and things can make it all better, and there's an authority out there that will all of a sudden solve it. So when you're told that you're wrong, or you get that sense that you're wrong or you're bad, it takes an enormous amount of courage to leap from that place into an open disclosure. And it's not from the place of the adult perspective today talking about the past. It's from the inside out in the other direction. And that kind of courage is enormous. And at those times when you then are treated harshly, it makes it worse. And those times when there are experiences such as Steve had with Allison, I really think that's what redemption means. Something is redeemed. The self is redeemed. There's something beyond where you can grow next. So I don't think redemption may be in the next life. I think it's right now, and this is it. It also took for all of these people an amazing amount of tenacity, an ability and skill and pain to work with a split between sexuality and spirituality that is inherited through Christianity and also through Mormon culture. I think that every coming out, even to oneself in one's mind, and then to other people, and then in front of a group of people, starts to build bridges between parts of the soul that were separated by someone else or by a culture out there. They were not originally divided. But the simplistic sense of self that we start to conceptualize ourselves with at a very young age is oftentimes templated on what's given out there and then incorporated inside. And so it takes a very mature person after going through many stages. This is not just homosexual people, these are heterosexual people also, because in heterosexuality there's also a huge split. That it takes many, many stages to understand there isn't a division, that you can experience sexuality and spirituality at the same time, and you get to choose how you do it. I also had the sense from reading these stories that we, because we have not had these stories before, we're getting them at a certain stage in each one of these people's lives for the most part. For the most people, it was the first time they had written it. So these are the stories of people newly out, just emerging from the cocoon. And so for many of these people, the whole story was a quality of this is my story, and it may be the whole story, and yet this story is very similar to every other kind of story you'll read of someone who has had to develop their sense of self in secrecy. These stories are the same stories as polygamous children's stories during the last century who could not tell who they were and had to have codes of secrecy so that the U.S. government people wouldn't take their parents to prison. These are the same stories as Jewish families for centuries in Europe. These are the same stories as sexual abuse victims have growing up and knowing they can't tell their horrible secret and they, in fact, are damned and awful and they have done something wrong to cause the abuse. Many of these stories are common to us all. We all have a part of ourselves we can't accept and have to learn gradually to redeem through our own sense of loving ourselves or through other people loving us when we're bad or wicked or awful or ashamed, even if we aren't. The other thing I noticed that I'll quickly run through in terms of reading all of these accounts, many more than are even published in the book, is that because the issue of homosexuality was so huge and so strong about sense of shame, not being able to define oneself, no experience base from which to understand, that many of these people did not have the relationship skills at times to develop a way of talking with people outside of themselves. That oftentimes when we define ourselves or have a sense of who we are from a very young age, our ability to express ourselves, understand ourselves, and speak stays at that stage. We only have simple all-or-none thinking or simple ways of expressing or simple ways of interacting. And so it's even more impressive in some sense that these people broke the silence and were able to say to their spouse when in fact they were so absorbed in trying to make sense of this story. It's the same way many sexual abuse victims are, too. To develop relationship skills is enormously difficult. You can talk to a child, you can talk at work, but that's in some sense a duologue to some extent, not with children necessarily, but at work with other people. To have a dialogue of real sense of two people communicating is an enormously difficult process to go through. And so many of these stories, it was clear there was not a relationship between the two people. Many other stories, it was clear they had a real friendship underlying it, but still in all, the intimacy skills of speaking something most vulnerable is very difficult, and I think they're on their way. I would love to see another set of stories, or these stories were written 10 years from now, because we are at the first stage. We don't know what the second stage looks like. We don't know what the next stage looks like beyond that. And that will only come. So these people are gradually becoming our role models, wittingly or unwittingly, to know how to carry something that is labeled and shamed into the open world and says, this is not shameful and I will carry it openly. The last thing I would like to say is that there are stories that are not included in this compilation of men and women who are, I think, either bisexual or they are homosexual or gay, but their sexual interest is not very high, who are in marriages, who their spouses know, and they have successful marriages. And those stories aren't yet written, and we don't know those. I know of actually several people where that's the case. I work with two couples in therapy at the moment where that's the case. And so I hope that you don't go away from this session believing that it's only one way. There is a broader range of homosexual experience than can be explained in one session. In fact, more than 10 years ago, there was a book published called Homosexualities, which I think represents the true state of things. Unfortunately, I've talked too much. I've taken over the question time. I'm sorry. We thank you for coming. Feel free to come up and talk to any of us after the session. We hope that any of you who have questions or have additional comments or have stories will please contact Dwight Cook, raise your hand, Rob Killian, raise your hand, and let them know of your experience or your questions. Thank you very much for coming.